Every immigrant, no matter where they come from, has a story to tell. The journey to a new land, the culture shock of being around new people and a new culture, and the struggle to survive, create an identity, and build a new life. As a second-generation immigrant from the Philippines, I often wonder how my upbringing shaped who I am today as an adult. A great way to better understand your story is to hear the stories of others. What do other immigrants go through? What are their experiences, and what can you learn about yours? Today's guest is Hoda Saloob, a mental health professional born in Somalia who grew up in Toronto and is currently in the Midwest. We spoke about living in the Midwest, the stress and anxiety of being in an immigrant family, and how to speak to immigrant parents about mental health. Come join us for an hour, grab yourself a cup of hot cocoa, kick your feet up, and tune in to another installment of Lag Radio. So Hoda, we were chatting a little bit earlier and you were sort of introing your family history. So let's start off, since our discussion is about, you know, growing up with immigrant parents, growing up as an immigrant, whether it's first generation or second generation. You were born in Somalia, you grew up in Toronto, and then you currently live in Minnesota. What's the story behind your parents' migration? You know, why did they leave East Africa and why did they choose Toronto of all places?
Okay, so my family left Somalia during the Civil War. So around 88, 89, mm-hmm. That's when we decided to leave what was known as Somalia, which is now the part that we're from is actually North Somalia, which is known as Somaliland. Mm-hmm. So, but back then it was Somalia. The Civil War is what kind of forced us to move. And we actually didn't just migrate from Somalia to Toronto. It was a transition. So we lived in Kenya, Nairobi, mm-hmm. for maybe 2 to 3 years while we were waiting for our refugee visas. And then we moved to Tanzania, where I had family over there. And we went to primary school, elementary, for a little bit and moved back to Kenya. And that's where we once we got our visas, we were able to move to Tennessee for a year, and then we moved to Toronto.
Oh my gosh! Like at that point, by the time you moved to Toronto, how old were you, and how, like, what was that like having to move internationally so much?
Right. So by that time, you know, I was used to moving around, mm-hmm. but I guess the biggest difference was moving to the West from living in Africa. And moving to the West. So Toronto was a huge culture shock, as you can imagine. yeah. So it was just really different and new experiences. I think we lived in Tennessee for maybe a year to a year and a half. That mm-hmm. was like our, I don't know exactly what the process is of, you know, coming here as a refugee, because I was very young at that mm-hmm. point. So by the time I got to Toronto, I was around maybe 10 in fourth grade. I remember uh-huh. being in fourth grade. So I was around 10 by the time I got to Toronto.
Wow. So when you got to Toronto, mm-hmm. and having lived, in Kenya and having lived in Somalia, what would you say were the biggest sort of culture shocks that you experienced within that first year?
Within the first year, I think it began before Toronto. I think within the first year of moving to Tennessee, mm-hmm. the biggest culture shock was seeing white people everywhere. Honestly, like, you know, coming from Africa where you didn't stick out because everyone looked like you, uh-huh. to coming to Tennessee and then going to Toronto, where majority of, you know, people were white, that was the biggest culture shock, just seeing white people around me all the time.
Yeah, it's funny. My experience is totally not as extreme, but I remember mm-hmm. Moving from the Bay Area and having lived in Eastside San Jose, which is predominantly, it's like 40% Asian, 40% Latino. And it's like maybe 3-5% white. And then we moved to Texas, and Texas predominantly white. And it was such a culture shock too, but I can only imagine. Mm-hmm. For you, and especially being so young,
right?
What was it like in Tennessee? I mean, Of all places, like that's.
Tennessee. Yeah, exactly. Man, it was really weird and different. And I think that particular year we were there, it snowed for maybe like a day or two. So that was already just a huge thing, you know, seeing snow, seeing white folks like everywhere. That was just really different. I mean, we had neighbors and I think they were kind of coached to be nice to us. I don't know what the deal was, but I remember our social worker telling the interpreter, well, we kind of told the, you know, the neighbors that, you know, we're getting new neighbors who are coming from Africa and, you know, you guys should introduce yourselves and be nicer. And that was weird to us.
Did it feel
Not that
fake?
it felt kind of because it was like they didn't know us. But and at the same time, though, it was nice. It's like these people don't know us, but they still came to say hi.
They're still like welcoming and all.
They're still welcoming, so that was really nice, even though we didn't really understand each other. But that was different, and for sure, I don't know if people do that still, you know, welcoming neighbors into their space. So that was really different.
I mean, for me, it's like I know that I'm not that type of neighbor. I know there's like a lot of cheeky white neighbors tend to be like that.
Yeah.
So like what were the would you say the logistics of moving to Tennessee and then also having grown up in Toronto, like in terms of being from a Somalian household and based off of your culture and your food, was there an infrastructure for like restaurants that you could eat at or grocery stores where you can at least buy stuff or you can possibly make some of the food from your culture? Like, how is it like over there? Because I know that different parts, like as a Filipino, it's like I can't always get great Filipino food in all parts of the state. So what was it like for you?
Right. Well, I was really young at that point. I think that was more like my aunt's duty. You know, they were the adults, so I wasn't really in tune with stuff like that. But I knew she was cooking for us, and she was cooking food that we were familiar with. So it wasn't like she was trying different foods because she couldn't find the ingredients. We had neighbors who were also from Somalia, so we were able to connect with them and ask them. So that was the beautiful thing about like having people who are, you know, your people around you. Not that there were that many, but the neighbors that we did have, we were able to connect. And I think they told my aunt where to go and my uncle, like where to shop, took them to the
Okay, so
grocery
you had like
store.
there's
Yeah.
already people there and you had relatives already?
No, we didn't have relatives. We just had people that were also from, you know, had the came through the same process, who were
Oh,
Somali, who
okay.
came through Kenya because of the civil war. We kind of, a lot of us have the same process. Like we go through the same process as far as migrating to the West. So we had neighbors that were not, we didn't know them, but we knew them because they were Somali. So there's always that commonality, you know, like, oh, you're my people. You start talking to each other.
Is there a particular history of like why Tennessee? Like, is there a Somalian community there?
There is. Back then, I don't think there was. I think we only knew because when you move into a new neighborhood and you hear like, oh, there's another like Somali family, you tend to look for them, especially if you're new. Do you know what I mean? It's like, oh, my people, like I have to go search for them because, you know, I want to know what they know. So I think that's what it was. We knew a couple of neighbors who were also Somali and we got together, went to the malls together, kind of, you know, we were seeking all these different adventures, I guess you could say in a way. But going to Toronto, I know there was a bigger Somali community over there for sure. Especially the northern Somalis, like where I'm from the Horn, the north. So there tends to be people from like my tribe that stay in Toronto more than the US. So that was really nice. And we definitely felt we were in a sense like at home because we lived in the same area. So, you know how
Because
that
like there's just
goes.
certain pockets where it's like your people are
Yeah.
there and like all the different shops. So it's like there's that enclave that feels like okay, it's this is home.
Yeah.
Like at what point and in what ways would you say you realized, hey, like I'm different than some of my peers, like outside of that circle of folks who are from Somalia, like were there certain moments where you're like, okay, I feel left out, or I feel like, gosh, like now your background is like you're starting to notice how much different you are from people who are either born in Toronto or born in Tennessee.
Oh, so like, are you saying like American born or Canadian born people
Or
who are
just
also?
like, I guess in other words, like, what were some of the differences that you noticed up front between you and, say, for example, like the white folks who were in the neighborhood? Like, oh, like, you know,
Right.
are we do this differently, or were there things that you felt you were singled out for, or that stood out? Like, oh, like, you know, I grew up differently than some of these folks, or were all your
Right.
friends Somalian?
No, I tend to have like a group. I for sure had a group of Somali friends, but I think as I got older, I kind of ventured out a little bit where I had like a group of Canadian, like white Canadian friends. And then I had Canada's truly like a really diverse place. So I had like a group of like mixed East Indian friends with Asians. You know, I tend to kind of gravitate towards everybody, but I noticed we were in groups. Like we weren't all like, you know, friends, one big group of friends. Like it was like, oh, if I wanted to talk to my Indian friends, like I had to go to that group. Do you know what I mean?
It's
We
like
all like, yeah, we
it's
segregated
diverse.
ourselves. Yeah. But we also had our little segregation, which to be honest with you, it's not as bad as here. I would say here is in the US is way more segregated than Canada. Like now, if you go to Toronto, you honestly feel like you're at the international market or something. It's really nice. Everyone is just kind of like living together, doing their own thing. I mean, there's issues everywhere, but I think the US for sure, like you can, once I moved here, I definitely felt the tension. And it was so weird because I haven't felt that over there.
So you said that you had moved from Toronto because the cost of living was
Yeah,
ridiculous. Well, for
right.
example, like how much would it have been to get a place like in Toronto versus how much would it be in Minnesota?
Well, the Midwest, I think, in this country, the Midwest is probably the cheapest place to live, because the weather is so horrible. I don't think anybody wants to be there. Like maybe 4 to 6 months out of the year, it's cold here. It might not be like freezing polar cold the whole time, but it's like
It's enough to be a
you're not comfortable, you know? You're not comfortable for sure. So I think people of color tend to not live in the Midwest, and it's cheaper to live here because it's predominantly whites in the Midwest. And I think in the West, in the East and the West Coast tend to be more expensive as far as like living costs. So Toronto would be in comparison to like New York, to be quite honest, because it's so like it's so big and everybody wants to be there. It's beautiful. Healthcare is free. The roads are so clean, and I mean, these are things that I always notice whenever I visit. It's just like, oh my God, the roads are so beautiful and clean. It's a beautiful place,
Isn't that
so.
wild? It's like that's how you know a place is so crap when you're just like, I miss the roads. It used to be so clean.
Yes, when I moved here, I was shocked by how close streetlights were to one another. Like that was shocking to me. It's like I can see five streetlights down from here. That's too much. You know, like in Minneapolis, the main city, it's just because of the cold winters and the harsh weather, the roads tend to always be under construction, especially in the summer. So, you know, I noticed those differences, but yeah, it's definitely very expensive to live there.
So now that you're in the Midwest and you've spent some time to get familiar with the neighborhood,
Right.
what particular things stand out as like, oh gosh, this is definitely the Midwest. This is definitely not my favorite area.
Right.
What are some of the unsavory things about living there for you?
For sure, I think the top thing is weather. And not to say, you know, it doesn't snow. Of course, it snows in Canada and it's freezing too, but I think you're more focused on the weather when there isn't much to do on top of that. So there isn't that, you know, lively culture that was in Toronto. So in the winter, you're really kind of feeling like you're cooped in because there isn't much to do other than like maybe here and there somebody's coming to do a concert. Of course, there's sporting events and stuff like that. But there isn't that culture, restaurants or street vendors are kind of open all night and you can kind of find things to do. There, that doesn't exist here. So you tend to feel, I feel for myself, like for sure, I feel cooped in a lot in the winter. I don't do winter sports. Like I used to do skiing in Canada, and it's just like, you know what? This is like too much work. I'm not enjoying
Yeah,
it.
it's
So
interesting how like these certain neighborhoods that are more out of the way, they're you don't get the sense that there's art being created and that there's a sense of liveliness in the city. And
right.
like you said, it combined with the cold weather or the really inclement weather, you almost feel like you're really just forced to stay inside and everyone else is inside. Now let's go to your upbringing and what it was like having having immigrant parents. One of the things that I've always thought about is how the behaviors and the stresses that my mom had would inevitably be passed down to me. If my mom was always worried about money, like that just ends up becoming the thing that you're always worried about. And it sort of goes in line with this idea of generational trauma and generational stress. What are some of the things that you'd say are behaviors that you inherited from your parents, whether it's negative, whether it's positive, but things that you feel from your upbringing that really stayed with you in adulthood?
For sure the money worries, worrying about money all the time, feeling like you don't have enough money. I think for my mother, she raised us as a single parent for the most part. So that was always something that I for sure think I inherited or kind of carried over into my adult life is definitely the money trouble, feeling like you don't have enough money for everything. And I tend to worry about that a lot too, which is like now that you said it, I do see the similarities. I mean, it's not only my mother. I feel like it's my community. Like we tend to have this thing where we worry about money and we're always trying to figure out how to get more of it. And like you said, like if you worry so much about it, it's like you always feel like you don't have enough. And I think school, they're overly, I wouldn't say over, maybe not overly, but school is such a big deal to immigrant parents,
Oh,
and
yeah.
getting like that top-notch education and not really focusing on what you want to do, but what makes the money. Sorry, coming back to that, right? It's all like this focus on this. We super focus on money all the time, and not really, they don't have. I don't know. Maybe they don't think in sense of like. Doing what you want to do to make money instead of like, oh, you need to go to school to be a doctor, be a nurse, be a lawyer. I think we all have the same speech. A lot of immigrant,
Oh,
parents
yeah.
say that to us, what are you doing? And I wanted to go to art school because I was more creative. And my mom was like, art school? How are you
What
going to make
art?
money with that? Dude, I'm like,
Very
mom,
relatable.
I could, I'm a good painter. I draw realistic things. I mean, I was drawing really well, like even in middle school. So I wanted to focus on that. And she's like, "What? How are you going to make any money? Do you want to be a starving person for the rest of your life?" And then you tend to do things that don't make you happy. This sense of like, I want to do what makes me happy. I think it's more like to them, it's like a Western thinking.
Oh yeah, they're like house.
Yeah.
What? Have your own dreams? Are you're
What do
so
you mean? Yeah.
spoiled.
What do you mean you want to be an artist? What is artist going to do for you or for humanity?
Oh my God, yeah.
So they're hyper focused on like, getting into school and doing this thing that you may not even be able to do, like nursing. Like I'm not interested in that.
Yeah.
I don't want to be sticking people with needles. You know what I mean?
And
So
that's and it's interesting because I know that so many immigrant families have that, especially if like I noticed having talked to so many different Asian immigrants and African immigrants, whose parents are super strict about like getting good grades and like going through this predetermined path of like you go to this school, you get this type of degree, like because if you have this type of pay, like and it almost feels like they have this huge vision of what is required just to survive here. And it's almost like their expectation of what it takes to just, live a comfortable life is outrageous. Like you have to be a doctor. And if you aren't, then you're just going to be homeless. Like as if those are the two extremes. It's either you are super rich or you're absolutely homeless. For you, like you talked about wanting to get into art. Like it was that something that you had cultivated a lot when you were younger, and what did you end up doing?
So yes, when I was younger, growing up in Canada, I think schools were, that's kind of like what they taught us, do make sure you find something that you want to do. So in my mind, I think I was living in two different cultures, In my mind, I'm thinking, oh, I do need to do what makes me happy because this is what I'm being taught. And at the same time, at home, it's like, no, you need to find something to do that will make you money so you're comfortable in life and you're not struggling like we were. That's always the thing, right? You need to do better than us. You need to live a more comfortable life because we sacrificed so much for you. So there's that pressure, right?
Oh my God,
From your parents putting it on you and thinking, like, if you don't do better than us, if you don't do, you have all these great goals and meet them and, and live this wonderful life, you're almost letting them down.
Oh my God,
Do you know what I mean? There's that. And it's such a pressure, when you put that on yourself, you're like, oh God, not only am I doing something I really don't enjoy doing, now I feel like if I don't go through with it, I'm letting my people down, I'm letting my parents down. They're constantly telling you that they've sacrificed so much for you to come here. So there's so much pressure, like, and they don't realize that.
I mean, the immigrant parents' favorite trip is the guilt trip. Like and it was interesting because, I was thinking about how that pressure, sometimes it doesn't even have to be this aggressive, like you have to do this, you have to do that, but it's just small little comments built up over time. And you just like the way that I sort of illustrate it is it's almost like they immigrant parents make you feel like your success has to be the reason why all of this was worth it. That your job and your ability to not only provide a life for yourself and also your kids, but also to be able to have enough to possibly take care of the family, to send money back home. And it's like you feel like there's just all these people depending on you, or there's just like the weight of your culture, the weight of this whole like, oh, then why did we even come here kind of a thing.
Exactly. It's so heavy, like all the time, and not like equally, but at the same time, it's like, and you do have a sense of a sense of you don't want to let them down. Like I do have a sense of guilt in a way sometimes when I feel like I didn't live up to the standard, like in a sense. But I mean, I end up not going to art school for sure. Because I was like, I'm not gonna make any money. I'm stressing my mother out because now she's stressed that she went through all this to bring me and my sisters here. And like, when are you going to art school? So I end up not going to art school and just having a lot of anxiety about that, like for many years, because I felt like
An opportunity.
I missed my calling in a sense. And I'm not saying we all have just one calling, but I think we have multiple callings in this lifetime. But in a sense, I felt like I missed what I was meant to do, and because I didn't want to let my whole family down. Do you know what I mean? And I end up getting into mental health because of that. And not to say I don't enjoy it. I do enjoy it, and it's part of me that really enjoys what I do right now. But there's also a part that always thinks about, like, what if? Like, what if I actually went through with what I wanted to do? And what if it went well, and what if it didn't? But at the end of the day, I'm still thinking about what if I went through with it, and And I, did what I wanted to do. What would have happened, you know?
And you also bring up a nice nuance of like where your parents want you to do one thing on one extreme end, but then you also have this other passion. And as much as you want to hold on to that passion, you end up having to compromise even just a little bit, where it's like you're doing the thing that you enjoy, but there's also that part of you that you just don't feel like is being satisfied. And you're like, man, and
Exactly.
you always just wonder, like, what would have happened? And you hear about people who did take that path and they did make it, and you're just like, wow, you know? I mean, not to say that for me, I'm ungrateful or I'm unhappy with, how my career path turned out, but it's always a thing that's in the back of your mind. Like, I wonder if my parents were like those white kids' parents who were like, oh, you can do whatever you want and I'll pay for whatever
Right.
lessons. And, I
Yeah.
always wonder, like, huh. But so for, do you still take time to satisfy that part of you, like that craving for art and creativity?
I do, I still paint, I still draw. For many years, I didn't because I felt like if this is not what I'm going to be doing for a living, like I don't see the sense of, I kind of wanted to get it out of my mind and just like focus on something else because I felt like I was letting myself down. So, but now, I mean, I still paint, I still draw. I do adult coloring books.
Oh, I love those.
Yeah, they're so like
So relaxing.
relaxing, so relaxing. And then I do those paint by numbers. Like, have you tried that?
Oh, yeah. It's like
Yeah.
they're all like in little grids, right? Or like
Yes.
little cells, and you can color based off of the
Yes.
number.
Those are so satisfying. I'll order them. I mean, they take forever to get here. But once you're done, it looks like a painting. It looks like you painted this. It looks really cool.
I have
So.
this one where it's like the pages are, it's like this black screen or this black film thingy, and it comes with this chopstick, and you're supposed to trace out the design, and it reveals underneath like there's this color, so there's like this little pattern, but it's within that category of like adult coloring books, adult like art therapy, which
Yeah.
I totally love, because like I grew up really into painting and art, and I was sort of the same thing where my mom was like, okay, well, at least get into business or something practical. So that's why I ended up getting into marketing, because it was sort of a merge of the two. Now, working in mental health,
Right.
how has that been for you, and sort of what meaning do you get out of it?
So working in mental health has actually been very satisfying. It definitely satisfies my need for helping people work out through their issues and also helping myself work through issues. Like a lot of it coming from, family, coming from community culture, being, trauma that's been definitely being passed down, and just like recognizing a lot of that has been really just shocking to me. You know, when you're not, I think when you're not in this field or in general, when you're in communities that don't really take mental health very serious or don't really even seek help, like my community, forget it. Like if you have mental health problems, it's just like pray about it, read the Quran, do what you can, but the seeking that help. And I think now more people are realizing, like even in my communities, you do need to seek help. To health. You do need to see a counselor. You do need to see a doctor for these things. Praying about it. It doesn't make you less, what do you call it? Like a person, it doesn't make you less closer to God because you're saying, like, this isn't helping me. Prayer isn't helping me alone. Prayer is great, but it's not helping getting rid of this anxiety that I'm feeling right now. Getting rid of like this depression I've been under. They're realizing now that we do need to seek mental health. And that's like, honestly, just it makes my heart health happy because it's like we don't have to live like this anymore. We don't have to sweep everything under the rug anymore. Do you know what I mean?
I
Little
mean,
by little, we're getting there. It's not like everyone's so awake to it right now and everyone's like embracing it. But at the same time, it's like I'm realizing that especially women in my community, they're the ones who are dealing with a lot of these problems, are telling each other, like in this woman group that I'm part of on Facebook. They're bringing it up and embracing that idea. So I'm so happy about that part.
Yeah, it's It's wild thinking about how even just now, within like millennials and Gen Xers, the increase in discussion about mental health has, grown rapidly in the last few years. But I can only imagine like how much our parents' generation has normalized the idea of, oh, if there's something wrong, you keep moving on. Just power through it. And I think about like a lot of these older generation immigrants who are the very stoic type, the ones who just don't really say anything, who keep to themselves. And, I think for a lot of immigrant families, like there isn't that outlet. They don't really talk about these things. There might be gossiping, but there isn't much discourse in terms of like, why are you that way? Why are you hurting. For you, like, how do you go about talking to somebody who, say, for example, has never talked about mental health for, they're in their 60s or whatever, and they've never really taken seriously their mental health. How would you, as a mental health professional, go about cracking that open?
I think for people who are obviously not used to asking for help, especially the older generations, in a sense, I don't think we need to bombard them with that information. I think we just need to have conversations with them. Like, talk to them, have them open up to you. That's, to me, that's how I talk to everybody. I don't say like, oh, you should seek this help, or you, I think you need to do this to
Correct.
get yourself better. I always think conversations open things up. If you talk to someone and ask them about, hey, how was your upbringing, or what did your family do? I think the more you talk to the older folks, the more they'll open up to you a little bit more. But I think telling them like, oh, mental health is important and you guys don't know anything about it and this is what you need to do. That's, everyone gets defensive when it comes to stuff like that.
Correct.
When you push those things onto them that they're not used to, things
Yeah.
that are like new things to them. Like, what do you mean talk to a professional? That's so intimidating.
Yeah,
So
because
I
it makes them feel like they're doing something wrong.
So to me, I just think having conversations, it doesn't have to be about mental health. It could be about anything. I think at some point, once someone warms up to you, then you can kind of slowly get there. And sometimes people of that age and that generation, they don't open up, but you have to take things for what they are. And if their lives are overall okay, and there isn't anything tragically going on, or there isn't any tragedy in their lives, like, they kind of go on. And so we really can't force this idea on a lot of the older generations. I think you can talk to them though, because for sure, like, my dad is of that age, and that's how I talk to him. Like, I just talk to him normally, like, Dad, can you tell me about, my childhood? Or when you were younger, when you married mom, how did that go? Like, how was your marriage? Like, did you guys know anything about marriage at that age? Because they married pretty young. So that's how I bring it up, because I want to know like how he dealt, how he was a husband. What kind of things he did to my mom, or what kind of things she did to him. Who taught you guys about marriage? That's what I would say. Like, how did you know, what to do in a marriage? And he would say, well, it's just a culture thing. Like, you're expected to get married. It's not like there's a book or someone is telling you what to do in that marriage.
That's just the
You kind
rule.
that's just you kind of do what other people do in the culture. You marry young, start having kids, there's that process. But when I ask him certain things like, well, how did you know how to be a husband? Like, did your dad teach you this? It's almost, they don't give you information to number one. They don't open up that easily. But like, my dad and I haven't really had a relationship. We left them behind in Somalia, so he's never moved to the West. So he had that against my mom for the longest. He was holding that grudge against her. He didn't want us to leave. But now, kind of trying to build a relationship with him is kind of like going backwards, because I want him to open up to me, which he kind of is starting to do. But it's little by little baby steps. Every conversation, it's going to be just a tiny bit more information from him. Like, I
And
tell him, like, tell me about my childhood. Like, what was I like as a kid? What were you like as a kid? How were you, being with my mother? How were you a husband? And he used to tell me, like, he was very angry. He was an angry person because he didn't want to be married at a young age, you
You
know?
seem I admire the fact that you're so diligent about, getting to know your dad's sort of upbringing and the way that he thinks. Were there any moments in your conversations with him that you that really stood out where you're like, wow, that's I didn't really know about that, or wow, that's exactly like me?
He's a really he has a really like calm personality. He's very, very quiet. It's hard to get a lot of things out of him. Our first conversations were really awkward, to say the least, because I couldn't get much out of him. I mean, he's an African dad. He's like taught to be an authority figure and the provider. He's not really taught to open up and talk. So I had to like understand, like, your dad is not going to be like you. And he's of a different generation, so you can't expect him to, give you these pieces in, of my life that I want to know. So I had to start, very slow. What was the question? I was kind
Oh,
of going
like,
on and on.
no, it's cool. It's like basically just based off of the
So
stories that
what?
your dad told you.
I think what really surprised me was because I've never known him to be a violent person. He's very calm and like quiet. My mother telling me stories about when they were younger, him being very abusive. And when I ask him, not in those words, but when I ask him, like, were you angry a lot when you were married? What made you angry? Was it because you didn't want to be married or because you married so young? I heard you were really angry when you were younger. Like, he would admit to that, and that was shocking to me because even though it's coming from my mom, it's not going to be the exact same story,
Correct.
So that's kind of how I went about that. And that was really when I heard from her, I was very shocked because number one, I never knew that about him. I guess it was a domestic thing, and we never saw it, me and my sister. And it's really sad, like when she was telling me about it, and then when I asked to kind of not confirm it, but to get his side of it. Just, how sad he was about that, because that's not who he is today. He was a young guy who was put in this situation and didn't know how to be a husband, didn't know how to handle that. So he was very angry. I think that shocked me the most, but maybe equally shocking is just getting my dad to say, I love you. Like at the end of the conversation, I always say, I love you, Dad, say it back. And he's like, at first he wouldn't say it back, like first few conversations. He was like, well, you know how you love your son? I'm like, yes. She's like, I love you the same way. I'm like, why do you have to go around it?
He said,
He
"I
was
it's like
going around it.
he wants to say everything around that phrase, but
Yeah. And I'm like, Dad, say it back. I'm like, say I love you too. Like, say it back. And then he just kept saying, I feel that you know how I feel about you. You're my eldest daughter. Of course I do. And I'm like, oh my God, this is so weird. But then it didn't occur to me that that's not normal for them to do. It's not a normal thing for them to say, I love you to their children. I mean, some people do, but older generations don't. I think they say, I love you through providing, through being a stern parent, through, kind of pushing them towards what they think will be a better life for them. I think those are their ways of kind of saying, but they don't directly say, oh, I love you.
I've written about how one of the reasons why so many people of color are super defensive about like cultural appropriation of food or disrespect of food is because for a lot of us, we grew up in households where our parents didn't necessarily say I love you. I mean, for my family, my mom was pretty open about that, but like food was always the way that you showed someone that you love them, and that food was the way that you showed that you cared. And for you and your family, like how since you said that your dad didn't, wasn't really accustomed to saying that, what was that relationship like? What were the expectations that your parents had on you? And how did you feel about them? Like, did they have a certain vision for how they wanted your life to turn out versus how you wanted your life to turn out?
I think for a lot of parents, especially mine, they, you know, of course they have visions and goals for me. Get a good paying job, get married first, then have children. That culture order where it's kind of the norm in a lot of cultures to was the way they wanted things for me, and it's I kind of did it backwards, actually. I felt like I don't want to marry someone because I'm expected to get married. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, you wanted to marry that person because that was what you like, that was your preference. Like you actually wanted to spend your time with that person.
Exactly. So I actually, you know, I went to school, finished halfway, met someone, had my son, went back to school, and then started my career and still did not marry my son's dad because I didn't feel like he was the right person for me. And I didn't feel like because we had a kid together, I like was forced or I felt like, you know, I didn't want to shame them. Do you know what I mean? Like my mom was like, "What? Just marry him. Just marry him. You're gonna have a kid together. Why are you? You know, you're already having a kid together. Why can't you just? It's just like, you know, I mean, a kid ties a person together forever. Children do that, but it's like marriage doesn't have to be forever. And I don't want to be tied down to the wrong person. You
Correct.
know, I want to get married, of course, one day. You know, to the right person, but I don't want to do it for the sake of, you know. Oh, now you have a kid, you've kind of brought this shame to us. Why don't you just marry him anyway, like as a cover up? And it was, to me, it felt wrong. Like at some point, I was kind of pressured into it by like almost everybody. And I felt like, what, you know, is it so bad and to marry someone? But then the fact that you have to say, is this person so bad? Is a sign in itself. It is so bad.
It's
You
like
don't need to marry that person, you know?
you're going against even your own intuition.
Yes, I had mixed feelings, and I felt like if I knew I was in love with this person and that's the person I saw in my life forever, I would never second guess that. But it's like the fact that I had to convince myself and say, well, I mean, is this such a bad idea because you do have a child together? And I'm like, you know what? The fact that I even have to ask myself, yes, it's a bad idea. So I think that was the best choice I made for myself, was just avoiding the wrong person to be tied down to, you know. So that's the path I took, and unfortunately, it's not the path they wanted for me, but I'm happy with it. And I think
That's
my
what
mom
matters.
has, right, and my mom has come around to, of course, they have to accept it at some point, you know. And my dad was really angry about it for the longest. I think he was more mad that I had a child out of wedlock more than anything, and he didn't want to talk to me as a result. For like many years, we didn't talk. He was very angry about that. And I told him, I said, you know, Dad, I don't want to marry the wrong person. I'm sorry that you feel disappointed, that you feel like I did something so wrong. And the fact that my son is not like full-blooded Somali, his dad is from the Virgin Islands. So the fact like I had someone, number one, I had a child out of wedlock, and number two, he was not a person in our community, was such a big deal
Yeah, it was like
to my
controversial
parents.
within the family. Thank you for listening to another installment of Lag Radio. Lag Radio is an independently produced podcast recorded and edited here in my home office, so I appreciate any and all support. Whether you share this podcast with your friends on social media or sign on to become a sponsor, there are plenty of ways that you can help out. Speaking of which, if you're a small business owner or a person of color who wants to promote your platform, business, or brand, contact me and you can become a sponsor of Lag Radio. We'll have you sponsor some of our episodes, and you can even join on to be a guest of the show. If you'd like to listen to previous episodes, you can find Lag Radio on anchor.fm/lagradio, or you can listen on any major podcasting app like Google, Spotify, or Apple.